and the plants that supply fresh water to almost 100 million people. Oil off Kashim Island extends more than 5 miles, 8 kilometers, and threatens both wildlife and people living along the coast of Iran, particularly those who rely on income with fishing. The 1991 Gulf War oil spill caused by Iraqi forces dumping 6 to 8 million barrels of crude oil into the Persian Gulf, damaged or killed about 114,000 animals, including turtles, birds, and dolphins and whales. Right now, there are dozens of tankers filled with about 5 trillion gallons of crude oil, 20 billion liters, sitting in the Persian Gulf waiting to exit through the Strait of Hormuz. And this is VA3KS. This is the Science Tech Net, transmitting from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. If you want to join us, come on in. If you have a comment, come on in with that. And I'm just going to go another one or two, but I think I'll do three more, and then we'll tie the ribbons for tonight. The next one about gravitational waves. They may be able to use gravitational waves for communicating across the cosmos. There are some limitations when you're using laser, even radio communications, but this has some interesting potential. Would you like to join us? Come on. For the vast majority of our communication, we rely on sending and receiving information by light, radio waves. And new research is exploring how we might be able to use gravitational waves to communicate over past distances. And research can now be found on the preprint server archive, so it's ARXIV. Beyond their impact on astronomical research, gravitational waves have drawn attention as a possible new way of communicating. Electromagnetic communication has its drawbacks. Signals become weaker with distance. This is the inverse square law. The atmosphere can distort and diffuse them, and don't forget restrictions imposed from line of sight and even solar weather. Gravitational waves are not affected by anything. To research this, scientists need to create artificial gravitational waves in a lab setting.
Space.
They're only detectable by using incredibly sensitive recording instruments such as LIGO, so that's a laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory. And the researchers have tried creating them from mechanical resonance and rotational devices, superconducting materials, and even particle beam collisions. Rotational masses would need to have incredible speed and be strong enough to overcome extreme forces. You rotate something that's big enough and massive enough, it tends to distort and pull space-time along with it, just drop it. And although gravitational waves, on paper, would make for a great way to communicate over vast distances, they aren't without problems. You have attenuation, phase distortion, polarization shifts, and what's more, scientists would need to find a way to modulate them. Dark matter might be a way to induce modulation, the same as we modulate radio signals. And practical applications for gravitational waves are still a long ways off. As an aside, just drop it. Theoretical models, and these mainly take place with string theory, suggest strongly that gravitational waves can pass into higher dimensions, which means that they're able to pass through dimensions greater than the ones we experience here, 3 of space and 1 of time. And passing or leaking into one of these dimensions would likely result in reduction of their amplitude, and research suggests that gravity might be so incredibly weak due to its passage through various dimensions. So they're thinking, unlike material here in this universe, which your view follows string theory, is anchored to a particular brain. A brain might think of that as a 1 or 2 or even 3-dimensional surface where all our physical properties are locked onto. But they think gravitation itself can transcend that and travel into other dimensions. And that means if there's multiple universes out there, gravitational waves from this universe could be actually traveling through other universes. And this is EA3KX, and this is the Science of TechNet. If you'd like to join us, you have a comment, come on in, and then we'll push on to the next one. This is about treetops glowing during storms. And Chris, V3RWJ, tap this thing. Chris, if you're still listening, thank you. And a team of meteorologists have recorded trees faintly glowing because of thunderstorms. This is called Corona. This is published in Geophysical Research Letters February 26th of this year. And the researchers observed a twinkle surrounding the tips of leaves in the UV wavelength. And the thunderstorm clouds, they're highly negatively charged, usually, you can have a different type too that's positively charged, but for the most part they're negatively charged, which then induces a positive ground charge. The ground charge climbs to the clouds, or attempts to climb to the clouds, which in forest areas means that they travel through the trees to the tips of the leaves. And the charges likely concentrate and produce a strong localized electric field. And the field excites the air molecules nearby, causing a plasma to form, and as the molecules relax to a less energetic state, they emit a photon, and the photons are light in the form of a shimmering corona dropping. And researchers at Pennsylvania State University decided to search for this UV and designed a detector just for this purpose only. They found a thunderstorm that lasted about 90 minutes, where they then observed two trees. Compared videos of the branches and were able to confirm that not only does the corona exist, but it can exist in multiple areas of different kinds of trees. And as it is right now, no one knows if this electrical activity actually damages the trees. Lab observations show that the leaf tips get burnt with just a few seconds of corona-like voltages, and it could be that the trees have evolved over the eons some sort of adaptation to these charges. So, coronal charges, discharges, have now been confirmed on the tips of the leaves of trees during thunderstorms. And the last one here for this evening, before I get into this one, this is about NASA. They're going to experiment with fire on the moon, or fire in space. And before I do, if you'd like to join us, or you have a comment, come on in. And then this next one about NASA doing some experimentation with fire on the moon. And they want to test this for critical safety purposes. The scientists want to test critical safety measures in anticipation of humanity's return to the moon. And the big concern is the prevention of fire outbreaks in space and how to deal with them. There's a brief report that was presented to the flammability of materials on the moon mission conference, which will test how fire works on the moon and eventually other planetary bodies. In late 2026, four solid fuel samples will be launched, and the samples will be ignited to record flame characteristics under lunar gravity for a lengthy period. Dropping. A fire aboard a space structure could easily turn catastrophic because fire behaves differently under microgravity conditions. On Earth, a flame often looks like a droplet rising upward due to the combination of rising hot gas and gravity's downward pull on cooler temp air. And this behavior doesn't happen in microgravity, where flames look rounder, almost completely spherical in shape. So to test fire in space, NASA engineers established a test called NASA STV-601B to find which materials are suitable for spaceflight. Latest reports on FM2, based on current experimental data, predict that lunar gravity could be extremely hazardous since flame spread rate is a function of gravity peak. fire on Earth is fed by colder air being pulled down by gravity and hotter gases rising upward. This loop sucks in oxygen from the bottom, resulting in faster spread of fire with more intensity. Just pop it. In microgravity, the same mechanism doesn't exist. There is no convection current to displace CO2 and bring in new oxygen. Fires will burn slower, so lower oxygen concentrations can produce much more persistent flames in space. And this is EA3KX, and that is it for the topics for this edition of the Science Net. Just before we head off, before I head off here, for any stations out there, if you'd like to check in with us before we head out, or you have a final comment before I tie the ribbons here this evening, come on. All right then, well, it's time to wrap things up, and this is the Science and Tech Net. I meet here each Saturday at my home location here in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, 9 p.m., 0100 hours GMT. And as I always do, I always like to thank the owner of the repeater that gets me through here each week, regardless whether they're listening or not, and those that help us through Canada Hub, etc. The net coordination station tonight is going to be H3TX. Thanks, everyone, for checking in, and this net is sponsored by the Skyward Amateur Radio Club. If you'd like to contact me, I'm on QRZ. My email address is there. Just drop it. And you can also contact me through the Skyward Amateur Radio Club's website. There's a section right on the home page there. You can click on that for the Science Net. The form pops up, and you can fill it out and then send me an email for whatever you'd like to talk about. So feel free to do either one of those, either QRZ or Skyward Amateur Radio Club's website if you want to contact me. Shopping. And if you have a topic of your own you'd like to present some Saturday, send me a line, let me know. We can have a mic for a little while, and I'm always open to feedback. So if you have any feedback about that, feel free to send that along as well. And with that, now the net is now closed, and I'll return the frequency to other amateur use. 73, everyone. Stay safe, stay well, and we'll talk to you again next weekend.
VE7SLZ.